Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our May Artist of the Month, Roger Joseph Manning Jr., is a musician and songwriter whose prowess as an instrumentalist and arranger can be heard on recordings by Beck, Johnny Cash, Adele, Glenn Campbell, Morrissey, and many others. He first garnered acclaim with Jellyfish, a band he formed with Andy Sturmer, a high school friend and fellow prodigiously talented singer and songwriter. They released two brilliant albums, 1990's Belly Button, which features guitar and bass work from our September 2016 Artist of the Month, Jason Faulkner, and 1993's Spilled Milk. But despite critical praise and a cult following, they disbanded. After several years of solo efforts, one-off collaborations, and in-demand session work, Roger has recently reunited with Eric Dover and Tim Smith from Jellyfish's final live lineup for a new project called The Licorice Quartet, which boasts an abundance of the qualities loved by Jellyfish fans. Strong melodies, smart lyrics, lush harmonies, and lavish arrangements. Roger phoned into Stereo Hysteria for a lengthy conversation about his career in music, which we'll be hearing over the next hour. But we'll start things off with a track from Roger's most recent solo release, the 2018 EP Glamping, called Operator.
Hello, friend. I confess a tragic tale to get off my chest.
Like to start off just by asking about your musical background, like if you grew up in a particularly musical household. I know your brother Chris obviously later joined you in Jellyfish, but Did either of your parents or extended family play instruments?
No, we don't really come from any musical lineage. I mean, my dad's brother was a drummer in the 60s and kind of played in a variety of bands and on the Sunset Strip during his young adult years, and he was just fine at it and had a great time. But it's not like he was a seasoned professional studio musician or anything like that who had, you know, aspirations to be kind of a musician's musician or a producer or a songwriter in any respect. He was very happy playing drums and being part of groups that were fronted by more the visionary, if you will. I was just always drawn to music, but I wanted to be like him and play drums. Hmm. My mom and dad were kind of aware enough to say, well, if we're going to actually throw down money to give him lessons, because he does seem to have some natural ability here, he might as well learn chords and harmony while he's doing it, which means guitar or piano. And so they set me up with piano lessons at the age of 5. There was a teenage girl who was teaching all the local kids in the neighborhood, and I had zero interest. I kept doing it because it was easy. I was like, okay, whatever. I'm gonna go out and play with my friends now. And it wasn't until high school when the two local junior highs merged into the high school in my small town I grew up in. There were lots of kids, but two in particular that played keyboard, and they were playing jazz and rock and all the stuff I was not learning growing up with traditional classical lessons. And suddenly they inspired me. It was like, oh my God, you can do this on the piano, and there's synthesizers and electric pianos. And so it was a real eye opener, and I was immediately hooked. So my one focus became, I guess, schoolwork and music. And schoolwork I didn't care about, and I just did the bare bones to get by and maintain to be average. And all my energy was put into music, and it was everything. It was how I was able to creatively express myself, and my spirit was able to be seen and be heard. And it was the only thing that made me feel good during the troubled, challenging teen years that everybody goes through to some degree. I had some pretty depressing bouts of it, as folks can. And thankfully, music was my drug of choice. So it always distracted me out of my pain in the most pleasurable way. And if anything, it made me want to, I just had a real focus. I just wanted to get better and better and better at it, because the more I gave to it, the more it made me feel good. And it was a very, very exciting time in high school with this kind of group of friends that I had, where we had no rules for what was cool and what was not. All we were interested in is what stimulated us. So punk rock, jazz, progressive rock, 60s psych, British new wave, synth pop, it didn't matter. If we felt there was something both intellectually stimulating and really evocative and emotional, I mean, it had to be motivating. And we didn't care if it was coming from the latest trendy new wave sensation out of England, or it was some old Miles Davis track from the 60s that we were just discovering for the first time. So all that is to say, we became little progressive jazz snobs and got really into the intellectual side of music, but got very interested in songwriting, because for years all we'd been doing was playing other people's music and improvising over it and learning other people's music. It never dawned on any of us to write original content. Mm. Like, well, that's what other people do, and then we perform it. And then one of our friends started experimenting writing his own ideas, and we were so blown away that he could do that, and it sounded pretty great, that we were inspired to do that. And so suddenly it was like starting over from square one. Suddenly I was like, oh my God, I can't write a good song idea. Like, every idea I try just sucks. Hmm. And I was determined to write one idea that I thought was cool enough to play for my friends, that was maybe somewhere as cool as a Beatles song I liked, or an XTC song I liked, or a Todd Rundgren song I liked. And that became the sole objective. So it's almost like I stopped practicing my instrument for a while. And that person from our group of friends that inspired us to do that was Andy Sturmer.
Okay.
And so we just wanted to try to write something as good as him. And we all went off to college in our separate ways, but Andy and I stayed in touch. I continued to try to get better and better at my craft on all levels. And I joined local bands that were all different styles. And I continued to practice jazz. But it was really about trying to show Andy, when I was invited to play keyboards for this band he was working with in San Francisco in the late 80s, you know, just try to keep up with him in terms of songwriting, because it was fun to work with him. I was like, well, if I'm going to work with him, I got to have some decent ideas. So it was a real commitment to try to do that.
From the deluxe edition of Jellyfish's second album, 1993's Spilt Milk, released a few years back by Omnivore Recordings, here's a demo made in 1988 of one of the first songs written by Sturmer and Manning, called Bye Bye Bye.
So there it is. All the truth is on the table, nothing to forgive. It's okay to start again. The wedding cake all but fades into a memory thrown in Cupid's face. Love's just frosting anyway. They both think back to long ago, and thoughts of them both growing old had given them the grayer they deserve. Singing bye 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 bye. Well, I've come to take you home. Another wife, neglected to the end, lives her own prison life. Solitaire's not just a game. She calls his bluff.
She isn't meaning.
Even though the tokens and gold watch were never enough to tell the time and start again. It seems all of these tragedies just last and last eternities. I've broken every bank and every bone.
So when you started co-writing songs with Andy, was Beatnik Beach still together? Because it seemed like when you joined the band, they were already signed to Atlantic and they already had two songwriters in Andy and Chris Kettner. When you started the co-songwriting with Andy, did you know that you had to start a new project, or were you thinking that they might become Beatnik Beach songs at some point?
Yeah, I mean, the assumption was that they'd become Beatnik Beach songs. I expressed to Andy right from the beginning that while I had a lot of respect and admiration for what he and Chris Kettner created in Beatnik Beach, I mean, no doubt, couldn't argue with it, that I was dreaming of a different sound, and that's where my heart truly lied. And Andy and I were such rabid songwriters, both independently and together, that it was just fun to get together and write. And what we started finding was the song ideas that were making us the happiest sounded pretty opposite of Beatnik Beach. And we tried some of them with the group, and because Chris Kettner and our two guitar players that we had at the time were great musicians, we could come up with arrangements for the ideas, and they sounded pretty darn good, but it became pretty clear to everybody, including the original Beatnik Beach band members, that Andy and I were just desperate to spread our wings, very hungry to just stretch out and realize this sound that we were clearly creating together. So it was just a natural evolution that was going to disband.
One of the things that I think really set Jellyfish apart from other bands at the time was how vintage the sound was. Like, it's clear from the albums that these aren't like sampled keyboards, but they're real Wurlitzers and spinets and that sort of thing. How did you have access to all of that cool gear? And was it difficult to recreate some of those sounds in a live setting?
We were very aware of the equipment we wanted to use, whether or not we had access to it or the money to procure it or just the ability to find it. Because like you said, a lot of it was vintage. A lot of used music stores were popping up at the time. We took some of the record company money and just scoured the used secondhand papers in Los Angeles. And the secondhand papers in Los Angeles, so pre-Craigslist, it was called The Recycler. And, you know, so many musicians have made Los Angeles their home, both professional and otherwise. Lots of equipment was up for sale. And we took some of the record company budget and bought it. Now, they were giving it away. It was so unappreciated and not valued by a certain generation that none of it cost much. The challenging part was to actually find it and find it in working condition. And then live, we had no choice but to sample a lot of the stuff. We didn't have the money or manpower to haul, nor did I want to be surrounded by 20 pieces of vintage gear on stage. I had no interest in coming across like a progressive rock band or having the keyboard castle. And 90% of the public wasn't going to know the difference anyway. So we were just all generating it from samplers, at least in my case. Everybody else had vintage amps and guitars and stuff.
Here's Jellyfish recorded live at Bogart's, a club in Long Beach, California, in 1991, with a song from their debut LP, Belly Button, titled Calling Sarah.
I know it sounds unfair. She's like a painting standing there. I think the heavens up above.
Also, the visual style of the band was a real anomaly at the time. I mean, pretty much at any time, apart from the mid-70s, maybe. I actually interviewed Jason a couple years back, and he was still sort of shaking his head about the wardrobe. I'm just wondering, like, did the music influence the clothes, or vice versa?
Well, you got to understand that four personalities are going to be different to a degree, no matter how much you can come together and form a band with a mostly singular vision. Mm-hmm. The visual aspect of the group, the clothing, for starters, was something that I had enjoyed in my own personal life and was really an extension of who I was at that time in my life. It was very natural for me to scour thrift stores and find outfits that I could wear out and on stage in a variety of band configurations. And my brother Chris shared that with me for sure. He was very extrovert that way. And he did, mostly, until he didn't. And Jason, from the start, and with no make wrong at all, was a frustrated solo artist because he didn't have a solo environment that he felt strong enough to stand on. Jellyfish was a prime opportunity for him to keep moving forward in the music business. And his musical contributions to Jellyfish can never be forgotten or underrated. They were absolutely exactly what the band needed at that time of our evolution. But he didn't necessarily share 100% the aesthetic, which is probably what he was sharing with you in the interview that you did with him.
Yeah.
What's very sad is that towards the breakup, I guess, Jason being the first to leave after about 2.5 years of working with us, I really felt, and I think everybody would agree if they were here to chime in, that we had all actually found a really happy compromise. In other words, we were all still very colorful and psychedelic and loud in our clothing, in our visuals, but everybody had really found, well, what's my kind of personal version of this? What's the Jason version of the look? What's the Andy version of the look? I think we all arrived there, and I see photos from right before we broke up and just live footage, and I'm like, that's it. We nailed it. Now, it would have been nice to stay together for another 5 years and continue on that path and then continue to evolve together as four personality. But that was not to be, you know. And then the same happened with the second version of the band. I think we all definitely found our essence and personalities, and I'm very happy and proud to stand by what it all became. But, you know, there's no doubt that first version of the band, we were very self-aware that we had nothing to do with the metal movement that was reigning on MTV at the time. And took great pride in being very different than them. We were shocked that the Black Crowes liked us at all. We could not understand. They fell in love with our music and our visual side, and we couldn't have been more grateful. And then when the second album came out, that was at the height of grunge. Metal had died an immediate, quick, instant death, and grunge rose out of those ashes to replace it by a new generation. And we couldn't have been more different than grunge. Thank God. It was very homogenous. While we liked plenty of grunge bands, you know, huge Soundgarden fans, we had nothing to do with what that scene was about, other than we could absolutely rock out as much as any of them. But we were very well received by Seattle and a lot of the grunge strongholds, and we did just fine. And again, had we not broken up, I really think that there's a very good chance that things would have really clicked for us in a more populist kind of way on the third album.
From 1993's Spilt Milk, here's a song featuring Roger on lead vocals in the verses, called Sabrina, Paste, and Play-Doh.
Far behind the forest of flying paper airplanes, grazing on the grounds of ponytails. The substitute is counting down her ticks till recess, hammering down to size her fingernails. Because today is the day Sabrina built her box lunch.
Kool-Aid, sandwiches, and chips for all the shoulders.
Lunch is on the table, soon dessert is on the floor. Looking
in his brand new dunce cap, strolling down the runway to an F. With all the others watching, eating paste and Play-Doh, he fights the urge to run and kiss the chef. But she's in love with Terry, and especially in the form. So he keeps his elbows off the table, but still for me. That he loves the girl behind the boys in Mary Fun. Sabrina makes me feel so serene.
I think it's safe to say that after Jellyfish broke up, a lot of fans still haven't gotten over it. My hypothesis is that power pop fans love what-if scenarios. Like, what if Badfinger stayed on Apple Records? What if XTC never stopped touring? What if there was a third Jellyfish album?
Right.
Like, I'm sure that kind of speculation isn't nearly as interesting to you as it is to some fans, but do you have a sense of where you would have liked the band to go had you continued?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what you've heard, but part of why we broke up, or at least Andy and I decided to end our personal and our writing relationship, is because after 5 years of collaborating and writing and producing in a certain way, Andy was definitely interested in bringing some other stylistic influences into the mix. And shortly before the band broke up, he and I were messing around with some song ideas and collaborations, just sharing. It was time to get a new record together, and we were, hey, what do you got? What ideas do you got? And he played me on guitar. He sang for me at the dining room table. To this day, one of the most beautiful country, like traditional country ballads I'd ever heard by anybody. And I was like, damn. And there was no room for collaboration. I was like, this song is done. And I was in awe and was reminded in that moment again, not that there was any doubt, but what a consummate songwriter, one of the greats that he is, will always be, and was sitting there right in front of me playing the song. And I remember saying to myself, that song is absolutely gorgeous and perfect in every way. And I have no interest in doing country music in our band. It's not what I want to put forth. That's not what I want to continue with the fans. What I wanted to do was to continue with the trajectory that we'd started with Belly Button, had fleshed out an even better and more complete way, in my opinion, on Spilt Milk. And I just, sky's the limit. I was just like, man, let's just keep going. We have more songs that are part of this sound. I was very proud of them. I was bringing more ideas in like that. But it was clear that he wanted to detour, not just a little bit, but quite a bit. And I'm not blaming him. I'm not saying he was wrong.
Right.
I'm saying that he simply was having a change of heart, and so it was very natural for us to end that journey that we had begun and established.
And after Jellyfish disbanded, you and Eric Dover formed Imperial Drag, and I think that their image also had a sort of over-the-top retro-ish quality, but with more of an adult overtone. Like, it was more Boogie Nights than H.R. Puffin stuff, if you will.
Sure.
How did you and Eric formulate the musical and stylistic sensibility of that project?
Right after Jellyfish broke up and I started reaching out to Tim and Eric with the possibility of, you know, what are you guys writing? What do you guys got going on? Because it was pretty clear to me during my time with them in the second phase of Jellyfish touring Spilt Milk that they were consummate songwriters and singers in their own right.
Right.
Obviously in Jellyfish, they were needed to the extent that they were good musicians and they could sing like birds. But I was not that familiar with their songwriting. I started to get a glimpse of that. So when the band broke up, I reached out to them. And Tim lived all the way in Atlanta. He was very much tied into his life there and his family. He also had a group that he was resurrecting with an old friend who were great, called the Umajets. Eric and I actually played on that briefly.
Okay.
But it was pretty clear that if I was going to pursue something with Tim, it was going to have a lot of built-in challenges. Whereas with Eric, he started flooding me with all these song ideas, and I was like, damn, this is not exactly where I wanted to head with Jellyfish had we stayed together, but it was meeting my interest of, kind of like you said, being more adult, rocking out in an even heavier way, mm-hmm. but still having lots of melody and pop sensibilities. And we went through a lot of trial and error to find the sound that you hear on Imperial Drag. You know, Eric's voice just, it records so well. He has such an undeniable lead voice.
Yeah.
And I was interested in seeing what I could do to take that places that he maybe never thought of, take it to a larger audience, take it to a Jellyfish audience and beyond. And we very much did that. I think in the process, we kept a lot of Jellyfish fans. We lost some, but we also gained a whole new audience in the process who appreciated the fact that we were heavier. Mm-hmm. And it was a really fun journey. It's not the Jellyfish journey, but it became its own thing. Life opens doors, and you decide you're at choice whether or not you're going to walk through them. And there's no wrong answer. It's just a different fork in the road.
From Imperial Drag's sole self-titled album, released in 1996, here's a standout called Breakfast by Tiger, Kiss It All Goodbye.
Clawmill sketching.
while I love my voice, I'm very proud of it. It's quite capable of doing many things that I'm thankful for. I've never seen my voice as a lead singer voice to the degree that collaborators like Andy Sturmer have and Eric Dover have. And I always felt that my voice, if I wasn't careful, was going to hold back the idea that I was going to present. Hmm. Whereas Andy's voice or Eric's voice could enhance the idea and see it through to fruition and carry it to the next level. And it takes a great amount of humility and self-awareness to be able to do that. I was very aware that this is what was going on. And if I wanted a career in music, I better figure out a way to be okay with that and make it work. And that's what I feel I've done for the most part, give or take a few mistakes here and there. but so be it. No regrets.
Yeah, it seems like that's a balance that you do pretty often, like between putting forth your own musical ideas and sort of subsuming yourself into someone else's vision. Like, you've got a pretty insane Discogs entry. Like, you've played on or arranged records by everyone from Blink-182 to Johnny Cash. What's your philosophy for contributing to someone else's record?
If they'll have me, I will not let you down. I love being given the challenge of helping to make a song as great as it can be with my skill set. In this case, that happens to be primarily keyboards. But as you're aware, I've done a lot of arranging of orchestral instruments, background vocals, and thankfully there have been artists who feel my contributions have been an asset. And I just love the challenge of what's it going to take to make this song as good as it can be. Hmm. There's no one way to get to the finish line. And that's what's so cool about this. That's what keeps it interesting and fun. I think my greatest training for being a sideman is that I have had such an interest in being a songwriter because I understand the craft of songwriting. And I understand that as cool as it can be to just sing the song and play it on guitar or play it on piano, and you just hear the raw idea, that the art of arranging and fleshing it out is a whole other school. In my youth, like I said, thinking that all I wanted to do is be the best keyboardist I could be, you studied how other keyboard players contributed to songs. Mm-hmm. So it's all these crafts and studies coming together. So what you hear on a Jellyfish album or the Licorice Quartet music or Imperial Drag or my solo stuff, any of the stuff that's been my songwriting contributions as well as my arranging and playing contributions, that's everything coming together. There's nothing more gratifying than that on your own songs. And I still really like doing it for other people too.
So there was this period in the mid-2000s where, like, you put out your first two solo albums. There was an album under your electronica alter ego Malibu. There was one with TV Eyes, your synth-pop collaboration with Brian Reitzel and Jason Faulkner. And all of those came out, at least initially, exclusively in Japan. Now, what was it about the Japanese market that responded so positively to your music?
Needless to say, particularly with my very first solo venture, which I was very proud of, but in a lot of ways didn't ever think would happen. Mm. Because I was too self-conscious that I couldn't really get to the finish line without some other talent, meaning another lead singer or a guitar player who played better guitar than me, or a bass player that played better bass than me, or whatever it was. So when I started realizing that, hey, lo and behold, I've got 12 songs here that I'm pretty darn proud of, and I did it all by myself by some miracle, I was still very self-conscious. And I said, well, who are the people that supported me? Because that's who I want to show it to. Mm-hmm. And the people that seem to understand Jellyfish and Imperial Drag and the Moog Cookbook and put their hard-earned cash down to buy it more than anyone of all the kind of groups around the world that we played for, it was Japan. No one asked us about the clothing. They just accepted it. Mm-hmm. No one asked us about the stage props and the cartoon videos. They just accepted it. Not only did they accept it, they became card-carrying members and devotees like we had never seen. They memorized all the lyrics. So when we played live shows there, they were singing every word, even though they were trying to mimic the English words. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, shit, if anybody's going to get this music, it's the Japanese. So I asked my lawyer to try to reach out to Japanese record companies first. And a company over there called Pony Canyon was very, very excited by that prospect, particularly a young woman named Kyoko Akioka. I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that properly, she couldn't have been more excited and couldn't have been more committed. She got me on Top 40 radio over there. I went over there and did an interview, and I'm at the radio station because I was going to do an interview and perform a little song live. And they're listening to the, we're listening to the top 10, and they played the first top 10 songs. They were counting down from 1 instead of going backwards from 20. And they played number 6, and it's Janet Jackson's new song. They play song number 7, and it's my song. And I'm like, how is this even happening? And they said, oh, no, we're getting quite a good response on your song. And my record company person said, yes, because we've seen a spike at radio, we're seeing a spike at sales at the record stores. And I'm like, this is how it's supposed to work everywhere. And yes, it was very short-lived, and I didn't sell as many units or have the success as, say, Janet Jackson. But I got to be a rock star in Japan for 2 weeks, and it couldn't have been more exciting and felt better. And they invited me to play the Fuji Rock Fest, which is their gigantic, Coachella festival. Mm-hmm. I'd played that with Beck, so I knew how big it was. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you got to be kidding me. I mean, maybe fly me over and I'll play some of the small clubs in Tokyo. I'm confident that I could sell some tickets for that, but there's no way you can book me at Fuji Fest. She goes, no, this will work out just fine. And I go, well, clearly I'm not going to be on a main stage. You're going to put me on one of the side tents, just like at Coachella. And she goes, yes, correct. We put you in the 5,000 tent. I go, there's no way I'm going to sell 5,000 tickets. And she goes, no, you will. It's not a problem. And I thought there was like a communication error that we just weren't understanding each other. So they advanced me the money. I got my band together. I paid them. I rehearsed them. Everybody flies out. I said to myself, look, I'll be happy if I walk out there and the tent is half full. That still means there's 2,500 Japanese people that I can't believe came to my show. The tent was entirely filled and overflowing. There were people outside the tent trying to see in.
Wow.
I'm like, how is this happening? So how do you not think you've died and gone to heaven? Because your dream is coming true right before your eyes.
Recorded live at Rogers' July 2006 appearance at the Fuji Rock Festival and released as a bonus track on his second solo album, 2008's Catnip Dynamite. This is You Were Right.
Another world is so living, good and right here. Just one false move could seal your fate. Everything's right in on this one. Yeah, there's way too much here at stake. And this riddle that you'll never ever solve, and confrontation so afraid. Please be advised that your next words could be thrown right back in your face. You were right, and up in my eyes I could see. Times and I care to admit, bent over backwards, turned inside out. So this time I'll try giving in. My heart is bound and tongue is tied. I'm all choked up, can't even look you in the eye. Way to predict what you need to hear. So reason left not to lie.
I was wrong, no need to go on and on.
once again I take the blame.
Take the blame.
Makes you feel better to have the last word. Have the last word.
Give your last word. It's all that you can pay. No more pain. I said that you were right. How many more times must you hear it? It's been one hell of a ride. I'm happy to step aside.
So that's a brief glimpse of what my Japanese experience was. And I got to have that twice, in 06 with the first album and then in 08 with Catnip Dynamite. Hmm. And unfortunately, at the end of 2008, it was time to do my taxes, time to pay my bills. And I went, oh, shit. I've been having a blast as a solo artist, but I don't have a lot of money to show for it and to live the life that I want to live and not have to go back to the hardware store to pay my bills or whatever 9-to-5 job I refuse to have. Because during that time of working on the solo records, I hadn't stayed in much communication with producers and other artists, and I was off the road from Beck and, you know, out of sight, out of mind. That's how a lot of this stuff works. Mm. If you're not hanging out, people are like, oh, Roger's doing his thing. That's cool. We'll call this other person. We'll leave him alone. And I was like, shit, this is not sustainable. I got to figure something out. So I stopped making solo records and I went head into other activities that were still music, but would, you know, get me a bigger paycheck. And that's the sad fact. And that's why there's no 2010 solo album, no 2012 solo album. And all the while I'm dreaming and figuring out how I'm going to make this work. I finally make it happen 10 years later in 2018 with Glampin. And there's a lot of boring in between shit, but, that's the life of a freelance musician. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
When did you, Eric, and Tim decide to start the Licorice Quartet? Have you kept in touch over the years? And, like, was there a sense that you had unfinished business from the Jellyfish or Imperial Drag days?
We had not really stayed in touch with each other on any great level. Eric and I took an extended break from each other, as band members that disband will often do.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get your space once in a while. But I would occasionally run into him at parties and gatherings. Tim was in Atlanta, so I never saw him. At the beginning of 2017, I think I was listening to Tim's Umajet stuff that he had with his old partner, Rob Aldrich, which Eric and I had played on a little bit, and just feeling really nostalgic and proud of how that music had come out, and just realizing what a crime it had been that we had never continued in any way. Literally kind of picking up the pop rock pieces, if you will, from when Jellyfish disbanded, because we all spoke that language. And if it wasn't for a handful of logistics, we would have probably had great fun just getting together on weekends and writing and demoing song ideas, just again, for fun, especially if Tim had lived in LA with me and Eric, say, for example. Mm-hmm. So I called Tim up and I said, look, I don't know what this means, what this phone call is about, but I want to write with you. If for no reason other than just for fun, maybe we even try it long distance or something. And then we talked about on that phone call, because he agreed with me, how great it would be to extend the offer to Eric if he was interested. So Tim actually flew out to LA at that time. It was in March of 2017. And we all met at Eric's house, where he had a nice garage space to work. And we just started sharing song ideas and hanging out again. And it was very weird and awkward and very natural and fun and easy at the same time. And there were no shortage of ideas, and we just kept chipping away. Tim was out for like a week or two, and then I think he came out again. And we basically assembled like 20 ideas that we thought were very solid. They needed to have lyrics written, but clearly there were strong verse-chorus ideas. And we had been telling our drummer friend, Jeremy Stacy, who Tim was very friendly with, that we had this thing we were doing, and he was like, oh man, well, if you ever want to record, I'm your drummer and I'll do it. I won't charge you guys what I normally charge to play on people's records, because he's a very successful session drummer. And then we just started biting it off one piece at a time. We tracked all the drums first, and so now we had these brilliant drum skeletons but no other instruments. And we just piecemealed it together one step at a time, one bit at a time. Tim would come out for 2 weeks, then 4 months would go by. And Tim would come out for another 2 weeks, then 4 months would go by. And in between, we'd try to work on the stuff on our computers from home. Mm-hmm. And that was doable to a degree. But in some ways, it made it more confusing, too, because we'd get together and now there were 50 guitar parts when all the song needed was two or three. Mm-hmm. So we had to sift through all the guitar parts and all the keyboard parts. You know, so it had its pros and cons, but that's how this record was made.
I'd like to ask about the song Lighthouse Spaceship, because it's just such an epic, and it just sounds like it was a lot of fun to put together, you know, a piece of ear candy that chewy.
Thank you. That song was fun to put together and was also hell. We conducted a ton of experiments that failed. There were tons of times where we flat out were stuck. We would get the verse sounding great, and then we'd get to the chorus and we'd go, crap. We're not doing anything that makes us feel like a chorus yet. And in fact, it sounds so unexciting when we get here, we're in trouble. Because the chorus has got to be more exciting than the verse, typically. You want to be excited to arrive at the chorus. You know, so it's just a lot of craftsman challenges like that. That was another idea. I actually wrote the verse and bridge that you hear, meaning the first part of the bridge. The chorus didn't exist yet. The whole outro, the 2.5 minute outro, did not exist yet. The extended instrumental of the bridge did not exist yet. And the three of us crafted that all together as a group. Eric wrote the lyric. You know, so we each show up and do our best job at whatever the song needs next. And then you just get together and you throw these ideas out and you take a vote. Somebody may have an idea and you go, you know what? That sounds like a good idea. But I just don't know till I hear it. Mm-hmm. So you got to spend 2 days trying the idea, getting it in tune, making sure it's all in time. You have the right keyboard sound. Now that's a crappy synth sound. Let's try this synth sound. No, that sucks. Let's try it on guitar. And you just keep experimenting. And then you get something. And then, okay, everybody, do we like it? And you listen back to it. And you're either going, oh, man, that's exactly what it needs. Or, nope, sucks. Back to the drawing board. That's a really frustrating process. That's not for everybody. Not everybody can do that. Because as you can imagine, it requires great patience and great faith in yourself and your team that you will eventually get there. And that's why this process is so much fun. But as fun as it is, it's as hard work.
The phone. If distress you're feeling, overhead clouds loom. From a lighthouse spaceship, I'll send a beacon out to you. If the stormy weather's loosened up your screws.
The Licorice Quartet with Lighthouse Spaceship, the closing track on their first EP, Threesome Volume 1, which will be released later this month on May 15th. And that's all the time we have for this week's episode. I'd like to thank Roger for taking the time to speak with Stereo Hysteria, and if you'd like more information on the Licorice Quartet, follow them on social media or check out their website at thelicoricequartet.com. Be sure to tune in again next week when we'll set our clocks back 30 years to listen to some of the finest music from 1990. This is Charlie, signing off.